to tonight's plenary session on the topic of how the manifesto has changed the church. We're going to begin tonight with a musical number by Susan and Chuck Krupa, and then we will have a prayer by Elizabeth Hall.
I always read a little verse before I do this song from King Benjamin. I'm starting in the middle of the verse. So I would that you should remember and always retain in remembrance the greatness of God and your own nothingness and his goodness and long-suffering towards you, unworthy creatures. We'd like to play Amazing Grace.
Thank you. Our Father in heaven, we're very thankful for that music which we just heard. We're thankful for the energy and work that go into making Sunstone and the symposium possible. We're thankful for each other. We're thankful for the diversity and the ideas and the goodwill that we are able to find here. We ask thee to bless those who will be performing this evening, that their minds will be clear and that they'll be able to do what they would like to do. And we ask thee to bless all of those who have yet to present papers or any other kind of thing. And we ask thee especially to bless us to have a lot of fun. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.
Yesterday when I was standing out in the hall, someone came up to me and asked me this question. They said, "Oh, what is this manifesto that you're all talking about?" I sort of felt like saying, "What closet have you been hiding in this year?" In case you don't know, the manifesto we're talking about is the manifesto issued by the Mormon Church in 1890, in September of 1890, ending the official practice of polygamy. And our topic tonight is how that manifesto then changed the church as it moved forward. Our first panel member tonight is Tom Alexander. Tom Alexander is a professor of history at the Brigham Young University, and he's director of the Charles Redd Center for Western Studies at BYU. His publications include A Dependent Commonwealth, Utah's Economy from Statehood to the Great Depression, Mormons and Gentiles, which he co-authored with Jim Allen, and Mormonism in Transition, which is a history of the Latter-day Saints between 1890 and 1930, which is this important time period that he will discuss today. He also brings to this discussion tonight a number of years of important study on the life of Wilford Woodruff. Tom has his PhD from Berkeley. And for those of us that are friends with Jesse Embry, we always describe Tom Alexander as the dream boss. On a typical workday, what I've heard, a typical workday is like down at the Charles Redd Center. They work really hard, and Tom is some taskmaster. He's sort of a pussycat, I think. But when they have a new secretary, he goes out and he says, "I'm going to court. I'll be back later." And apparently each one of these new secretaries needs to be instructed that Tom Alexander does not have incredible problems with the law, but that he's going to play handball with Jim Allen. And in the summer and in the spring when he and Jim play golf, he says that he's going out to do range research, which I think the academic life down at BYU sounds pretty good. Our second speaker will be Michael Quinn. Michael Quinn has his PhD from Yale. Michael also taught for a number of years down at Brigham Young University. Michael has published a number of books and articles. In 1986, he won the Best Article Award from the Mormon History Association for his important article, LDS Church Authority and New Plural Marriages Between 1890 and 1904, which was published in Dialogue, 1985. I think that Mike Quinn is the best mind to come out of my generation of Mormon historians. He certainly has a remarkable, expansive intellect. He sets standards for the rest of us that I think are virtually impossible to reach. And I think he challenges us to search for truth wherever it takes us and to accept the consequences of what we find. Michael right now is a freelance writer and what Gary Bergera describes as a vagabond. Rumors about Michael say that he is writing up to 4 or 5 books, which again sets a standard that no mortal being could possibly consider to match, but that he will most likely accomplish with the same level of excellence that all of his work exemplifies. I have found one thing. Michael and I have a number of common friends, and that people who are friends with Michael have intense feelings about him. There's just no middle ground with Michael Quinn. The people that care about him intensely, would die for him, and almost always love to claim decades and decades of friendship with him. And our final speaker will be Jan Shipps. Jan Schips wrote the book Mormonism, The Story of a New Religious Tradition, which was described by Richard Bushman as the most brilliant book ever written on Mormonism. That's some compliment coming from some tremendous historian himself. Jan is a professor of history and religious studies and director of the Center for American Studies at Indiana University, Purdue University at Indianapolis. And she is often described as that beloved inside outsider because she is studying those of us who are members of the Mormon faith from an outsider's viewpoint. She first confronted the Mormons in 1960 when she traveled to Logan with her husband, where she worked to complete a bachelor's degree in history. And I think there she realized how complicated the Mormon religion and Mormon society really was. Later, as their family moved to Boulder, she wrote a master's thesis on Mormonism called The Mormons in Politics, 1839 through 1844. And in 1865, she wrote a doctoral dissertation called The Mormons in Politics, 1844. Oh, never mind. She wrote a master's thesis and a doctoral dissertation on Mormon topics. After moving to Indiana and becoming a professor of history and religious studies, she continued to contribute important studies on Mormonism. For 3 years, she was a member of the Council of the Mormon History Association, and in 1979 through 80, she served as president of that organization. You know, there are not many role models for those of us who study Mormon history and just happen to be women and just happen to be mothers, and I think that Jan Schips is one of those, and probably the very best that there is. She is the best example of how you can be remarkably bright, a welcome part of the boys' club, a committed wife and mother, sexy and warm. There you have it. We have three very interesting speakers, and we'll proceed beginning with Tom.
I appreciated that introduction in which you mentioned that I was a pussycat, Marty. I've been trying to convince my wife and children of that for, these many years. And it's been very difficult, I must admit, but that's true, Marilyn. I told a friend of mine who likes to work on the welfare farm that I was going to talk today a little bit about the Mormon worldview and the change in the Mormon worldview over time, and he asked me whether I meant that I was going to talk about something on the top of the Empire State Building or the top of Timpanogos or perhaps the top of Eramiumptum. And I assured him that that really wasn't the kind of worldview that I was going to discuss. And I assume that most of you are a bit more sophisticated than my welfare farm friend, and I'm going to talk about the complex of ideas and feelings and attitudes and other mental components that constitute the way in which people construct and understand reality. I think in order to understand the manifesto that Wilford Woodruff issued in September of 1890, it's necessary to understand some of the changes that took place in the church over the period before and after the manifesto, and to look at the context in which those changes took place. And basically that's what I want to do this evening by talking in some general terms about the changes in Mormon worldview over this period. I must say at the outset that these have to be taken as a preliminary set of suggestions, and that my view of these questions is influenced very heavily by the work that I've been doing on Wilford Woodruff, particularly his diaries and correspondence over a lifetime from 1833 until 1898 of membership in the church. And I would say at the outset that Latter-day Saints in the 19th century looked at the world not only differently than we do today, that is, their worldview was a great deal different, but differently than most Americans looked at the world in the 19th century. And I think that this was because they looked at the world through the lens of modern revelation and through an apocalyptic interpretation of ancient scripture and modern scripture. And what I mean by that, basically, is that through the 19th century, at least down through the early 1880s, Latter-day Saints expected the second coming to take place very soon, Christ to return, and that they would be saved in some way from the difficulties that they faced during that period. Now let me, for a moment, try to construct the worldview of the Latter-day Saints in the pre-Utah period. During that period, it seems to me, the average Mormon lived in what I would call an undifferentiated temporal and spiritual world. And I hasten to add that I use the word temporal rather than secular for a number of reasons. In the first place, it was a word that they used themselves. And in the second place, it translates very well into our world today, because it doesn't carry with it the connotation of a-religious or even anti-religious that the term secular does, and yet the term temporal has to do with the here and now, with those things that are taking place here upon the earth. So that in describing the worldview of Latter-day Saints in the pre-Utah period, I would say that it was an undifferentiated temporo-spiritual world. By temporo-spiritual, I mean that they recognized no division between the temporal and the spiritual. The activities that they carried on in this life had spiritual and temporal significance in a continuum. They lived as part of a gathered community, which they purposely tried to separate in every practical way from the remainder of the world. It's true that they interacted with the outside world, but they tried to limit the degree of that interaction as much as possible through electing their own people to offices when that was possible, through trading as much as possible with their own people, with people who were also part of that gathered community, through following the advice of their prophetic leaders in matters temporal and spiritual. And again, it sounds like a separation. I don't know how to emphasize more than this, that differentiation which we tend to see today between temporal and spiritual simply was not part of their worldview. This gathered community had particular purposes. They believed they were creating a society which combined the temporal and spiritual, and they perceived their community as the kingdom of God here on the earth. They expected Christ to return and the millennium to begin within the near future. This undifferentiated temporal-spiritual world continued after the settlement in Utah until the experience of the Utah War. They established their own government, and now for the first time they had a prophet, Brigham Young, as their governor, leaders from their own community as their lawgivers within the territorial legislature. And this created problems with federal appointees who came out to Utah. The Mormons could safely ignore these people until they got the attention, that is, the appointees got the attention of political leaders in Washington. And the Utah War of 1857-58 was the result of that. The Buchanan administration sent an army out to Utah to put down what they thought was a rebellion here, and sent a set of new appointees to take the place of these Mormon leaders. In fact, what the Utah War did was to begin the process of unraveling that undifferent temporo-spiritual conception that constituted the Mormon worldview. Now, any of you who've done embroidery work or have watched an embroiderer recognize that what the embroiderer starts with is a strand of embroidery floss that consists of six different strands. And what they do then is to separate those into two units of three that they begin to use in embroidering. And it seems to me that you can use that analogy in talking about what happened to this undifferentiated temporo-spiritual world of the Latter-day Saints. They began to separate it into two parts. This disruption was caused by the threat from Johnston's army, followed by the presence of footloose soldiers in the community, various camp followers, saloon keepers, prostitutes, and others. The increased violence in their community, which had not been present before. The appointment of a Gentile governor. The introduction of new officials. All of these things pulled at this spiritual and temporal strands of that community. In addition to this, the move south, where they left left Salt Lake City and began to move toward the south, created unbelievable disorder within the Mormon community, which tugged even harder at those strands that held this temporal-spiritual worldview together. I would hasten to add that the Mormon society was not secularized in any sense of the term. The Latter-day Saints simply began to think of temporal and spiritual as separate spheres. Moreover, this separation of the temporal and spiritual doesn't mean that they gave up trying to control the temporal sphere. Most emphatically, they tried as much as possible to control both spiritual and temporal. This is important, however. What's important, however, is not the question of control, but rather that the Latter-day Saints began to see these two spheres. Now, Brigham Young, for instance, was so shaken by this experience that he insisted that there be no public worship in the Latter-day Saint community from the time that they returned from the move south in July of 1858 until in January of 1859. And he had the leaders in the community set up prayer circles of friends of theirs where they met together in private, talked about matters that were important to them, and conducted prayer rituals. Some leaders, and I draw particularly upon Wilford Woodruff's experience and writings as an indication of this, began to think and talk in terms of the separation of these two spheres, the temporal and religious. He mentioned on occasion in his diary, for instance, that he had written two letters to his son, Wilford Jr., who was on a mission in England from April of 1863 through October of 1866. And in the cases, he would say that he had written a temporal letter and a spiritual letter to his son. Now, that was something that would have been unthinkable for Wilford Woodruff before that time. And it indicates, I think, in his mind, the feeling that those two spheres had become separated in some way, that they had begun to pull apart like the strands of floss. Still, and this is too important as well, they continued to try to control both the spiritual and temporal realms. The size of the Gentile community continued to grow in their midst. After Johnston's army left, Patrick Connor and the California Volunteers came in. They came to guard the Overland Mail route and also to take care of the Mormons and to promote other business activities such as mining. Connor tried to promote that. In all of their activities, Connor hoped to induce more Gentiles to come to Utah. In the late 1860s, of course, that community, the Mormon community, was disrupted even more by the introduction of the railroad and an increasing non-Mormon element in Utah. The church leadership responded to these efforts to try to undermine their control of temporal affairs by tightening the temporal strands within the Mormon community. In 1862, they revived the Council of 50, which had been dormant over much of that period. They drafted a constitution for the state of Deseret and tried to secure statehood. When that failed, they used the Council of 50 and an organization of the state of Deseret as kind of a ghost government, with Brigham Young as governor of the territory. After the territorial legislature met, they would reconvene again. Brigham Young would give his governor's message to the territorial legislature, and they would pass legislation for the state of Deseret. In response to the Gentiles' challenge, they organized their own political party, the People's Party, with a regular political organization like other parties. They offered candidates for various temporal offices. All of this was under church control, but before the separation of the temporal and spiritual, they hadn't found it necessary to organize a separate political party, because all of this had been operated directly through the church organization. This is a subtle difference, that is, the organization of a political party as opposed to having the whole matter operated through the church. But it is a difference nevertheless, and I think that it's an indication of this change in worldview that's taking place during that period. Moreover, they founded various temporal organizations to try to control economic life during this period, such as boycotts against Gentiles, setting up ventures like ZCMI, trying to promote united orders during the 1870s. All of these were designed to maintain control over various aspects of temporal life. In spite of the unraveling of the spiritual and temporal, the saints continued to hold a spiritual worldview which was similar to that that they had held before the Utah period. They continued to expect Christ's imminent second coming. This sense of the apocalyptic was particularly intense during the American Civil War. And it intensified also during the anti-polygamy prosecutions of the early 1880s. They expected some sort of divine intervention to save them from their persecutors. From their point of view, this was religious persecution and not temporal persecution, and that it would be met by a religious answer. The coming of Christ. If you read the revelation given to Wilford Woodruff, for instance, in 1880, the wilderness revelation, read his impressions of that revelation, the activities of the Council of the Twelve. This was before the First Presidency was reorganized, and the activities of the First Presidency and Council of the Twelve after John Taylor became president of the church. It's clear that expectation, it seems to me, continued in the Mormon community. By the late 1880s, this apocalyptic form of protection had not materialized, and church members began to seek other means of protecting themselves. Since the Mormons had already begun to see the temporal and spiritual unravel from one another, they realized that they could seek the help of friendly Gentiles in the temporal sphere to help them as long as they retained control over their own temporal affairs. So what they began to do was to offer fusion tickets in Salt Lake City for political office. And they began to seek outside help, particularly during the early part of Wilford Woodruff's administration, by going to national political leaders in the Democratic and Republican parties and trying to get them to help to secure statehood for Utah and to secure assistance in various other ways. Involved in this was the attempt to include friendly Gentiles within the political structure, within this temporal structure, as long as they cooperated with one another. So you have the organization by Mormons and Gentiles of a Chamber of Commerce, for instance, in Salt Lake City and in other communities. Now, with this background, it seems to me we can go on to interpret what the changes that took place at around the time of the manifesto indicated. It seems to me that the significance of the manifesto lay not so much in the temporal changes that were taking place, because those had already begun before the manifesto was issued, but rather the changes in the Mormon spiritual worldview that allowed the manifesto to be issued. I would argue that if the Utah War marked the beginning of the unraveling of the temporal and spiritual strands, that the manifesto marked the beginning of the shrinkage of the spiritual portion of the Mormon worldview. By what I mean by that is that the Latter-day Saints began to move in a direction of having the spiritual portion of their worldview coincide with the limits that American society set on the spiritual worldview of people. And by that, I mean that for Latter-day Saints, the idea of the apocalyptic, the expectation of divine intervention to save them, then recedes into the background. Latter-day Saints still continue to believe that the millennium is going to take place. And when troubles take place in the world or here in the United States, you see this perception coming over and over again that maybe this means that the millennium is coming up soon. And I expect that we'll see in this Middle East crisis rumors flying through the Latter-day Saint community that this means the millennium's coming, that something's going to happen in the Middle East. But in every case, this is pushed off into to the future in some way. What happened, basically, is that Wilford Woodruff came to the conclusion, giving prayerful consideration to this matter, in the summer of 1890, that divine intervention was not going to save them from the problems that they had with the United States. The suits had been entered to confiscate. It was not an event. That is, this isn't something that happens immediately on September the 24th of 1890. President Woodruff, his successors as prophets, seers, and revelators, and other general authorities as well, saw this as basically a spiritual change in the Mormon community. That is, they faced particular problems, such as the loss of their temples, their chapels, and other religious property. They considered the matter carefully, sought the Lord carefully for inspiration about what to do under those circumstances. The results of that inspiration further divided the temporal from the spiritual, but began to change the content of the spiritual worldview within the Mormon community. Basically, the church leadership redefined the spiritual realm to include basically those areas acceptable to the majority of Mormons, or the majority of Americans. As the process continued, they redefined that area to include principally personal piety, public and private worship, and various rituals, including temple rituals. The manifesto itself was undoubtedly the most important symbol of the changes that were taking place over that period. In part, this still meant that the church has decided to compromise by suppressing plural marriage in order to save the temples. Like the changes in the definition of the temporal realm, which had begun earlier, the changes in the definition of the spiritual realm should be perceived as a process rather than an event. And I need to emphasize that this was a process. After all, it took 33 years from the time of the Utah War before the church leadership had redefined the temporal realm sufficiently to allow members to join national political parties. And that's a long time of activity within that temporal area. The redefinition of the spiritual realm lasted even longer. For instance, it's no longer possible, it seems to me, to argue that plural marriages ended in 1890. Plural marriage continued to occur with the approval of some church leaders at least until 1904. Some plural marriages took place after that. But by 1911, the church leadership began to deal in church courts with new polygamists, and that effort accelerated during the 1920s and 1930s. With the understanding that these changes in spiritual worldview constituted a process rather than an event, it's possible to see the period between 1887 and 1890 as the beginning of the process of redefinition of that spiritual worldview. It's possible to see the revelation that underpinned the manifesto as the most significant statement that that process was underway. Most important, as the church leadership defined the scope of the temporal area, they defined the church's relationship to temporal affairs much differently than they had in the Utah War period. Again, this was a process rather than an event. What they did, basically, was to accept traditional American pluralism as the basis for the temporal realm. And I should add that this was not absolute pluralism, but traditional American pluralism. That meant that after the church abolished its own political party in 1891, it would not ignore politics any more than any other large organization in the United States ignores politics. Rather, like most large organizations, the church began to play the role of interest group rather than political party as it had before. I could go into this at greater length, but I think that's not necessary. Frankly, I find shocked comments about the fact that the church takes an interest in politics to be sort of like a little boy who's learned that the stork didn't deliver him down the chimney. He finds out something about sex. Under the traditional system of pluralism, like the one that we have in the United States, religious groups involve themselves in political issues just like any other group does. Instead of operating its own political party, however, the church works as an interest group, lobbying on various issues like other groups do. In Utah, with a population of over 70% Mormon, it's certainly a very powerful interest group, perhaps the most powerful in the state. The important point, however, is this is not evidence to support the argument that no change took place. It is rather evidence that the church began to define the area of its activity, traditional pluralism, in a way similar to that of other Americans, so that it defined the temporal area in which it operated. So that temporal area, its temporal worldview, became compatible with the temporal worldview of other Americans. And it did essentially the same thing in the spiritual area. The church moved to place increasing emphasis upon local community rather than the general church organization. The ward became increasingly the primary community within the church. Such measurements of activity in the ward as sacrament meeting, attendance at sacrament meeting and priesthood meeting, attendance at mutual and Sunday school and relief society became increasingly important. The church leadership placed increasing emphasis upon observable personal piety. Again, this took place over a long period of time, but the church adopted an increasingly bureaucratic model and came increasingly to measure personal piety by willingness to take local assignments, diligence in ward teaching, home teaching, visiting teaching, payment of tithes, attendance at meetings, word of wisdom, things of that sort. Beginning in the 1920s, the church began to emphasize temple attendance and more recently doing genealogy and keeping journals. The significant feature, then, of these events surrounding the Manifesto, it seems to me, involved the redefinition of the spiritual portion of the Mormon worldview. The apocalyptic expectation of the imminent return of Christ and the destruction of the American government, the miraculous salvation of the Latter-day Saints from their oppressors, and the inauguration of the millennium, all of those things were pushed into the background. This emphasis on personal piety that emerged then during this period, under the leadership of the church leaders, fit well within the realm that most Americans were willing to carve out for themselves as the realm in which religion could operate. I should emphasize that that doesn't mean that the Mormon worldview was the same as the worldview of other Americans. It simply means that it was compatible with that worldview because the boundaries within which the spiritual area fit was generally compatible with what was acceptable to most Americans. And this seems to me to be then the significance of the Manifesto. That is, that like the changes that began to take place after the Utah War in the temporal realm, the spiritual realm began to change significantly during the period immediately following the Manifesto. Thank you.
It's difficult for us today to appreciate how Mormons originally regarded the Manifesto because we look at it completely differently. Most of the people in this gathering regard the Manifesto as a good thing. And in fact, many here view the Manifesto as doing away with something that should never have existed to begin with. And that attitude and that perception removes us in large measure in a world of difference from Mormons who were confronted with the publication of the manifesto in September 1890. There have been only two events that I'm aware of in the Mormon experience that were regarded as inconceivable. Two events that were regarded as well as those events which God would never allow to happen because they would represent utter disaster, utter disaster for all that Mormons perceived Mormonism to stand for. The first was the death of Joseph Smith. The second was the manifesto. I know of nothing that compares with those two events because Mormons perceive those as impossible to occur and that God would not allow them to occur. And when they occurred, that required an enormous shift of perception, religious, spiritual perception. And that shift is multidimensional. And I'm not disagreeing with anything that probably anyone will say or has said about the manifesto, but I think there are other ways of understanding it, and the way I'm going to suggest we understand it is in terms of the identification of the oppressed with the oppressor, which is kind of psychosocial, but I think that's what happened in Mormon experience. And it goes back to what Wilford Woodruff himself said about the impossibility of a manifesto when he was an apostle. Brigham Young had actually led the way, but it's significant to refer to Wilford Woodruff because he was the one who eventually, as church president, issued and published under his sole signature a manifesto which his counselors would not sign with him. They refused to. They would not. And the Quorum of the Twelve was not invited to as a quorum, debate or ratify it because Wilford Woodruff anticipated they would not sustain it. And so he published it in a consultation with only three apostles, and after that consultation then published it under his sole signature. But while he was an apostle, years before, he said on several occasions, and these were published to the world in the Deseret News and later in the more now readily available Journal of Discourses, his view of what it would mean if, in fact, the church abandoned the practice of plural marriage. He said, paraphrasing him, that we could never abandon the practice of plural marriage. Because if we did, then we would have to give up marriage for time and eternity. We would have to give up baptism for the dead. We would have to give up the endowment. We would have to give up, in fact, the priesthood and everything that identified Mormons as Mormons. Because giving up plural marriage would simply be a symbol or a manifestation of an entire surrender of everything that it was to be Mormon. And he said that repeatedly. And then he did the unthinkable. He did that which he and Mormons for generations had regarded as impossible, that God would never allow to happen, the surrender of plural marriage. And there is no way to regard the Manifesto of 1890 except in any other terms than as a surrender. It was a unilateral surrender, in fact. Modern Mormons have sometimes said it was a victory. That's from the modern Mormon point of view. From the point of view of Mormons in the 1890s, or rather up to 1890, it was the inconceivable. And it was, when it occurred, regarded universally by Mormons as a surrender. And we're not just talking about polygamists. monogamous were as committed to this view of the impossibility of surrendering plural marriage as a practice as were Mormon polygamists. It wasn't just simply whose ox is being gored. All Mormons felt their ox was being gored by the issuance of the manifesto. Because they had this perception that in surrendering the practice of plural marriage, they may as well surrender everything. Once, in fact, the manifesto did surrender plural marriage, then anything was possible. And that brings me to the other side of this, and that is the identification of the person who is experiencing aggression with the aggressor. On a personal level, we can see this with children, with battered children, who frequently grow up to become battering parents. They identify in a process that's easier to see in its final form than it is to see how it occurs step by step, but they identify with the battering parent of their childhood, and they replay that behavior as they themselves become parents. In a group experience, we can see it in what's called the Stockholm Syndrome, where hostages, not always, but hostages sometimes identify with the hostage takers and because of the intensity of the experience, identify with and even become defensive of the people who have put them in a life-threatening situation. And the whole process is more involved than I can get into, and I'm certainly no expert on this, but it seems to also be connected with the degree of dependence that the oppressed person has to the oppressor, that tends to link psychologically the oppressed to the oppressor and identify with the oppressor. Now, if we go back to the 19th century experience of Mormonism, Mormons had a very ambivalent attitude toward the American culture, the American government, as they understood it and as they experienced it. On the one hand, Mormons were anti-pluralistic. They saw themselves as God's chosen, and they, from section 98 of the Doctrine and Covenants forward, there was this sense that Mormons are separate. And that if there is ever going to be a choice between God's law and the law of man, between God's leaders and leaders of men, we must always give priority to God, his commandments, his leaders. And yet, Mormons had a perception of America as well as God's chosen country. And there was almost, inevitably, a sense of devotion, of pride, of connection with the American government, with everything that America represented, almost in a child-parent relationship. Well, that was a brutal parent. And increasingly, from the mid-1800s onward, the relationship with the parent figure became more and more brutal. And when that brutality of Professor Alexander mentioned, the Utah War, and then the various elements of the polygamy crusade intensified, that brutality became increasingly overwhelming until the surrender of the manifesto. But what I see happening, and again, the final symptoms, I think, are easier to identify than the step-by-step implementation of them, is that Mormonism, as with many battered children, as with hostages, as we can describe in the Stockholm Syndrome, Mormonism identified with the aggressor parent figure or nation figure, however you want to define it. And just as battered children take on those characteristics of the battering parent, Mormonism linked itself and identified itself with Victorian America. And as a culture, Mormon culture began to take on those points of reference of Victorian culture and became locked into replicating, essentially, in Mormon culture what Mormons perceived as the character of America up to the time of the Manifesto. And just as battered children cease to identify with their parents as they are growing older and becoming grandparents, they identify with the parents at the time of the battering. They don't update the changes that are occurring in the parents' lives and personalities. That's what happened with Mormon society as well. From the 1890s onward, America was in tremendous change. But Mormon society continued to refer back to Victorian models and began to identify and bring into Mormon experience the models, the expectations of Victorian America, not of 20th century America, not of the Gilded, or not of the Roaring Twenties, or anything that has developed since then. The point of reference was Victorian America. If you look at that in a number of dimensions, prior to the Manifesto, in most respects, Mormon was countercultural. Its attitudes toward women were countercultural. Its attitudes toward economics were countercultural. Its attitudes toward business were countercultural. And the counterculture was against American culture, Victorian society. From the Manifesto onward, the Mormon society is seeking to identify with American society, but it's not contemporary American society. It's Victorian American society. And so the irony is that as American society is developing greater, for example, with reference to women, greater autonomy for women, Mormon society is moving toward an ideal of Victorian women. And so that Mormon society, over time, seeks to identify with the aggressor, Victorian society, and seeks to bring into Mormon attitudes toward opportunities given to women that would be parallel to or sympathetic to the aggressive society of mid-19th century America, Victorian society. And the kind of autonomy that not only was experienced, but was even encouraged in the mid-19th century within Mormonism for women, increasingly disappears. At the same time, American society is allowing more and more autonomy for women. And that seems like an anachronism. I mean, it seems like a reversal. Unless you see that what American or what Mormon society is doing is it's identifying with its aggressor. And its aggressor was Victorian society in the business community. The model there are the robber barons. The model there in the business society is interlocking directorates. It's the use of business power to essentially do what historians have defined as compensate for what was the weakened spring of government in mid-19th century Victorian America, a government that was weak and therefore business filled the vacuum, so to speak, and was able to influence America in ways that business was not, or rather that government was not capable of doing, and therefore government became a sense, essentially an agent of the business community by this pervasive influence of business. By the late 1890s, this is beginning to decline in America, and in the early 1900s, government itself, under Vaughan in particular, begins to attack business and seeks in, for various reasons, some of them even welcomed by the business community, to regulate business. But the Mormon development of business from the general authority level onward is in the very kinds of things that are changing in American society, but are developing increasingly within Mormon society. And that is the use of business to implement larger social goals in a world in which, in the Victorian sense, business is more powerful than government, and business becomes an agency through interlocking directorates, through use of business influence to shape social goals that was operating in Victorian society, and that begins operating in Mormon society. The role of the manifesto in American society was minimal. It simply erased or compensated for or addressed the problem that Americans had been complaining about, they defined as Uncle Sam's abscess. That was what Utah was to mid-19th century Americans. For Mormons, it was a transformation. It was the surrender of that which could not be surrendered, but in fact now was surrendered. And once you do the unthinkable, once you do that which God was going to prevent, that God would never allow, then many changes are possible. And among them is the surrender of the economic community, the lack of competition, that Mormons should not compete against Mormons, the idea that there should be a community cooperation, that goes out the window, finally and fully with the manifesto. The idea of political compromise that Mormons felt should not be necessary, the idea of alternative candidates that Mormons felt was actually contrary to the spirit of the gospel, that becomes fundamental. The use of business to influence social outcomes, that was not a part of the Mormon perception in the early 1890s, and before the 1890s, it became so after that. And one item after another, in terms of the Mormon worldview that Professor Alexander referred to, that changes after the manifesto. And the manifesto indicates the arrival of a new world. And these processes occur gradually. No one came up and announced, well, now that we've surrendered plural marriage, we're going to change our perception of government, we're going to change our perception of business, we're going to change our attitude toward women. Those weren't announcements. But they developed gradually as consequences of the manifesto. And Mormonism today is radically different from what Mormonism was in the 1880s, what it was in the 1870s, what it was in the 1860s. You may regard that as a good thing. You may regard that change as desirable. You may see the manifesto as a victory because of the world that you are accustomed to, that you feel comfortable with. But you are a different kind of Mormon than Mormons were more than a century ago. And the manifesto is the reason for it. And in many ways, it is because the manifesto was the dramatic, unthinkable, final event in this oppression that Mormon society experienced from the parent figure of the United States government. And from that time forward, Mormon society identified in very interesting ways with Victorian society. And if you look at conference reports, the America that the general authorities of the LDS Church extol, the virtues that American society extol, or that Mormons leaders extol, those virtues are really Victorian virtues. It's a Victorian worldview. Ronald Reagan did the same thing. He was as removed from reality as others. But the fact remains that it is an appeal. It is not an appeal to contemporary, even contemporary values of American society. It's appeal to older values that in many ways are linked with that time period before the roaring 90s in American society, and certainly before World War I, before the roaring 20s, before the Depression, before World War II, before any of the things that any of us have lived through. It's another world. And we are another church. And we are other kinds of Mormons. And if you don't realize that, it's going to be very difficult for you to read your great-grandfather's journal and have any perception of what he or your great-grandmother were talking about in their hopes and in their fears. Because what they feared is what you're living. What they hope for is, in large measure, what you don't even think of. And with that, I'll conclude my comments on the significance of the manifesto.
Oh, whether I should feel this way, but I feel a little bit like a referee here. We have had two presentations. Tom sees the manifesto, and I will, although when I'm teaching at the university, I'm very careful to say Professor Alexander and this and that and the other thing. It's Tom and Mike. Tom sees the manifesto as a stage in a very complicated process. He argues that it was not an event. Mike sees the manifesto as an event. And so we have a very real difference of opinion here. And I'm not sure whether my presentation will... I'm not sure on which side it will come down, because it's been a while since I looked at it from that standpoint. But before I start, because I'm really going to talk about what the manifesto did to the community in a particular way, I want to raise a couple of questions that just occurred to me as these two people were talking. Mike says the role of the manifesto was minimal in American society. And I agree in a sense that the role of the manifesto itself was in fact minimal in the American society. But the role of the fight against the manifesto was extremely important to an America trying to hold on to the sacrality of the nuclear family. And I really wonder if, in fact, the role of the church's fight today against the new polygamy might not be much the same thing as it... And in this sense, I think that Mike captures something that did happen, that you look at the way American society saw polygamy, and since Marty said use that word sexy, for somebody that's 60 years old, that's unusual to say the least, but... but nevertheless, this whole issue of the way in which American society accused Mormon men of being oversexed and it being necessary for them to go out and find several people to have sex with. Well, now you find that same kind of response about the new polygamy. It's just sex. It's just sex. I have recently been going through the circular letters of the First Presidency, and to my amazement came across a reflection on whether it was just sex that was was causing the new polygamy. Anyway, so back to the my prepared comments. I am going to talk a little bit about the Mormon community and how the manifesto, whether it be an event or a stage in a process, can help us understand divisions within the Mormon community. Contrary to perennially popular notions from the outside that Mormonism is and ever has been a monolithic movement in which internal conformity is rigorously enforced, diversity has never been entirely alien to the LDS community. During the pioneer period, the reality of the Mormon experience made universal suppression of dissident behavior and unconventional beliefs so difficult that despite all the overblown stereotypes of the LDS leaders' refusal to countenance dissent, and notwithstanding all the fictionalized accounts of the terrible fate awaiting apostates, a surprising degree of multiformity was tolerated within the LDS church. Moreover, there were yet other Mormons in the Utah LDS community who were not even a part of the church over which Brigham Young presided. The claims of the Brighamites, as the saints who followed Young were sometimes called, were contested firsthand in Utah territory by the Josephites, members of the reorganized church, led by the prophet's eldest son. And there were other Mormons, too, saints who first moved into and then back out of the church without following up their ecclesiastical exits, which were often but not always voluntary, with physical removal from the society of their former faithmates. Some of the persons in this interesting ex-Mormon category stayed in Utah for economic reasons. Others, for one reason or another, who were bitter toward the church, seem to have remained in the Mormon community mainly to act as thorns in the sides of the almighty hierarchy. But many of the Mormons stayed in the LDS community because even as they rejected the legitimacy of the church organization and the authority of its leaders, or as they were rejected themselves by the church, they continued in their own ways to affirm the truth of the LDS gospel. Disagreement about matters of faith, then, some novelty which first made its appearance in the LDS community after that community was no longer effectively set apart from the larger world. Still, while intra-Mormon diversity was not new in the early 20th century, developments during the transition period, I guess this puts me down on the side of Tom, more than Mike in a sense, allowed the diversity to become more intense. Before 1890, while they had occupied the same geographical space, Utah's Mormon and non-Mormon populations had existed almost in separate communities with separate structures of internal governance and separate systems of internal cohesion. Serving to counterpoise one another, each community set limits on the degree of tolerable diversity in the other. But with the coming of statehood in 1896, the interpenetration of the two communities occurred. And as the Gentile barrier around the LDS community grew progressively weaker, the latent diversity within the Mormon world became and started to flourish. Obvious ethnic background differences had made for a variety in the LDS population long before the pioneer era. Lineage had made a difference historically, too. The making of distinctions between the Latter-day Saints, whose families had been long in the church, and new LDS converts had been possible for decades. And the making of distinctions between the members of the families of the Mormon elite, whose main of business had been running the church, and the members of ordinary, everyday Mormon families had likewise been possible for years. But a different form of diversity started to cut across these more or less traditional LDS population categories during the 1890s and soon after. Perhaps it would be an overstatement to say that LDS subcultures came into being during this time. Nevertheless, the general character of Mormondom became much more complex between 1889 and 1918 or 1930 or whatever, but especially in that early period between 1889 and 1918, when Joseph F. Smith died. Unlike ethnic and lineage differences, however, the differences which developed during the transition period were sometimes subtle and often not easy to recognize. Yet, since the complexity of the LDS community is such an incredibly essential ingredient in understanding the modern Mormon story, it needs to be considered if we're looking at the impact of the manifesto. Now, one way to get at this diversity and at this complexity is to look at how the saints reacted to the claim, not to the manifesto itself, but to the claim that the manifesto was a change that issued from continuing revelation, and that, as it always had been, the LDS Church was still the only true church of Jesus Christ. One subgroup of saints accepted the changed context in Mormonism had its being, while maintaining at the same time a perception of the necessary totality of the role of the church and its priesthood in all the areas of life, both temporal and spiritual. In other words, one group of Latter-day Saints, it seems to me, held on to Mormonism as it had been, as Tom says, way back before the Utah War. They paid little attention to the constant external pressures that seemed to be forcing the church into at least outward conformity with the prevailing religious pattern in the United States, simply rejecting the idea that spiritual concerns belonged in the ecclesiastical province and everything else belonged in the civil province. Now, exactly how many of these people there were, I don't know, but I believe that some of them continued to believe that spiritual and temporal did not come unraveled, and that embroidery thread was still together. They continued to accept encouragement and direction from the priesthood in temporal as well as spiritual things without posing sharp questions about whether such encouragement and direction were appropriate or not. At the other extreme, there were Mormons who disagreed so completely with the continuity principle that they refused to accept either spiritual or temporal direction and counsel from the church's leaders. Certain that the restored priesthood had done nothing which could have brought its legitimacy into question, but equally certain that the church, which Joseph F. Smith headed, was no longer Christ's church, they made counterclaims to the past, repudiating the church organization, and hence the notion that Mormonism's former leaders would ever stand in the background and nod approvingly at modern LDS General Conference proceedings. They sought out new leaders whose programs would bring back official sanction for the practice of plural marriage and its inevitable accompaniment, separation from the world. These were the early fundamentalists, and they testified by their behavior to their conviction that a radical break divided the modern church from early Mormonism. In leaving the church or being pushed out, they did not believe that they were leaving Mormonism, however, and this is the important thing. Instead, they believed that Mormonism had left them, and that in staying out of harmony with the church organization, they were staying in harmony with the gospel. Among the saints who adopted one or the other of these two polar positions, one believing that it was that the manifesto was the result of continuing revelation, and the other believing it was not. Among the saints who adopted these polar positions, a definite correspondence existed between the acceptance of the continuity principle and continuing church activity on the one hand, and rejection of that principle as far as it dealt with the manifesto and refusal to participate in church activity. But along the Mormon spectrum, which, as it were, connected these two extreme positions, a comparable correspondence cannot be discerned because diminished church activity could mean several different things. There were many saints, for example, whose diminished church activity did not reflect their belief that the church had changed, but rather that it had not changed at all. These were the saints who had expected that after the church had divested itself of polygamy and dissolved the church-supported People's Political Party, it would begin to focus its primary attention on spiritual things alone. Obviously dissatisfied because the church's adoption of the American pattern was only partial and disapprovingly superficial, they complained bitterly about the way the church still tried to run their private lives and about the fact that the priesthood had never ceased its meddling in temporal things like politics. Diminished church activity could, however, reflect an opposite belief. In the early 20th century community in Utah, some of the saints were afraid that too much accommodation was going on. Aware that the Mormons could no longer separate themselves from the world by the practice of plural marriage, they clearly wanted their community to maintain its boundary through other means. Closest to hand for this purpose was, of course, the Word of Wisdom, advice on the subject of health which had given to the saints. Although it was originally given not by commandment or constraint, the prophet's advice gradually assumed the character of commandment, so that recommendations that the saints should abstain from alcohol, tobacco, and hot drinks were turned into mandatory stipulations. As abstinence from these items came more and more to function as the visible sign that the Mormon community intended to maintain its policy of staying unspotted from the world, strong sentiment developed for the passage of a statewide measure that would bring complete prohibition of the sale and consumption of alcoholic beverages to Utah. Mormons who feared that theirs was becoming a mere Sunday religion were very anxious for the church to indicate otherwise by exercising its influence in behalf of statewide prohibition, and were bitterly, bitterly disappointed when the church did not do so, but in fact came out in the other direction in the early part of the century. These Latter-day Saints, who were so upset about the churches being too little or too much involved in things temporal, that they gave public voice to their dissatisfaction, were occasionally tried for their fellowship. But as a general rule, disfellowshipping or excommunication followed expressions of dissatisfaction about what was happening in the church only if the legitimacy of the church and its priesthood were brought into question. Although blatant complaining about the activities of the general authorities and other priesthood leaders was hard to ignore, the circumstances in which such complaints were made known and intra-church diversity usually worked together to allow saints to stay in harmony with their quorums, even as they worried about what was happening to the church as a whole. This means that the manifesto is one way to look at and get sense of an increasing variation in the LDS community. It was not just a function between Mormons who accepted priesthood direction without question and those who refused to accept priesthood direction, but it was a way of looking at the way saints tried to fit into the new changed world in which diversity rather than uniformity was the way to go.
We'll now take questions from the floor. All right.
What, Jan, what was the answer to the question whether or not polygamy was viewed as just for sex or not?
Well, it was not a...
Wait. Hold it. I need to restate the question for the recording, and then you need to take the microphone. His question was, what was the answer in response to whether or not, in the letter that Jan had reviewed, whether or not polygamy was for sex or not?
Well,
there wasn't any answer. It was just a sort of puzzlement. Just sort of, I wonder if this is what's going on. Not an accusation even, but a puzzlement.
I might mention that when J. Reuben Clark was asked that question as first counselor in the first presidency, his answer was that these are just dirty old birds out for extra wives. And so his position was very much that there was only one motivation for new plural marriage after the manifesto, and that it was sex.
How quickly we forget.
Any other questions? The question is, did they consider moving, and if so,
why not?
Why not?
Well, during the time of the Utah War, they considered that. They sent an expedition down the White Mountains, but that didn't pan out. It clearly wasn't a place they could move to. During the 1880s, of course, they did move some people. Some moved to Mexico. Mother. Some moved to Canada. But I don't think that the general authorities ever seriously considered trying to do something like move the whole Mormon community out of this area in the late 1880s. I think that was essentially unthinkable because the community was so large, it simply would have been impossible. I don't know any serious consideration that was given to that possibility. Do either?
There was no serious consideration, but there was an apocalyptic one, and that is the view that a number of Mormons had that if the whole church went into Mexico, eventually that would be a first step into going back to redeem the God-given land of Zion in Missouri, and that they would redeem it by a sojourn temporarily in Mexico. But I know of no serious discussion on the part of church leaders for making a church move, but within the rank and file, there was an apocalyptic view of it.
The church leadership was approached by people to try to get it to move. There were a group of promoters from Nicaragua, American promoters, who were promoting land on the Mosquito Coast, the area where the Mosquito Indians lived. Some of you may have seen the movie Mosquito Coast. That they were trying to get the general authorities to purchase that land from them and move the saints down to that area. Wilford Woodruff thought that the guy was nuts and wouldn't have anything to do with him. It simply was out of the question as far as he was concerned.
I have three questions, and it's actually a line of inquiry. I address it to Mike because he raised the issue, and I don't know how to follow up this line of inquiry except by asking three little questions. One, it has to do with Wilford Woodruff. Is it your belief that when he wrote the manifesto, and maybe these are settled issues in history, but I don't know, was he sincere? And then I have two other questions. If he was sincere, what was the subsequent event? I mean, how was it that he was not supported in this decision by the other church leaders, and what was the dynamic there? And if he wasn't sincere, then when was it in the history of the church that the leadership finally decided that they had to be sincere about the abandonment of polygamy?
The question of sincerity is a difficult one to answer because it depends on how you define sincerity. The day that Wilford Woodruff presented the manifesto to the General Conference, I think there are two events that are extraordinarily important about that. When it was read before the General Conference in October 1890, as it was read, tears were streaming down Wilford Woodruff's face. And he had feared that the general membership of the church would not sustain it, that they would vote against it. And in fact, two-thirds of the audience refused to vote at all. The manifesto was voted for by a minority of the people in the Salt Lake Tabernacle that day. But those who voted, voted to sustain it. No one voted against it. On the other hand, on that same day that he presented the manifesto to the General Conference to sustain the word and will of the Lord for the church, he signed recommends for about 8 new plural marriages to be performed in Mexico. So there was a complex definition of what is to be sincere, what it is to be truthful, what it is to abandon, and those definitions cut across not only the border, but also the United States itself, because more plural marriages were performed in the United States after 1890 than were performed anywhere else. And that also linked with your status in the church. If you had high status, you stayed in the United States for your plural marriage. If you had lesser status, you went to Mexico. And that cost money. And it's curious that the ones who could most afford to go to Mexico were the ones who stayed in the United States for the ceremonies. The ones who could least afford it were the ones who had to save up and spend the money for the train fare to Mexico for the ceremony to be performed by Anthony Ivins. So I really don't know how to answer your question, except to say that it was complex and that it was a confusing situation in which a number of general authorities themselves didn't know what to think of the manifesto. Everyone was brave. I think that's probably the best way to describe it. There were no heroes with white hats fighting villains with black hats in that period from 1890 to 1904. Everyone was brave, everyone was good, everyone was honest, everyone was faithful. And yet they were on different sides of the same issue. Should plural marriage continue? That was the question.
Was there a time, though, later when the confusion began to clarify into a consensus position?
The second manifesto had that ability of clarifying it into a black and white issue. Even then it was muddy, but not as muddy as it was before the second manifesto of 1904. As Professor Alexander mentioned, there were a few, less than a dozen authorized plural marriages after the second manifesto. But the problem was that those overlapped with the beginning of plural marriages performed by fundamentalist authority and under fundamentalist definitions. And that made it a real mulligan stew, to use the Irish phrase.
I want to ask the question. It's supposed to be a panel. We're supposed to be able to talk to each other as well as you. Way back in the 1960s, when I was working on my dissertation on the Mormons and politics, and knew really very little about you guys, I didn't know you in the flesh. I just knew in the books and in the records. But I came to the conclusion, or I made a kind of speculation, that there may have been some thought in the minds of the general authorities that if they would give up the practice of polygamy until they became a state, that then the state would control the marriage laws and it could become legal again. Was that speculation totally out of the question, or do you think that's a possibility?
Yeah, I think it was a possibility.
There was another side of it, too, and that is the eminence of the second coming of Christ. That's why a number of the apostles could, and it was very difficult for them to accept the manifesto at all, but that's why a number of them did accept it, because they felt that the second coming was so close that it wouldn't matter a great deal if no new plural marriages were performed, because they were talking about maybe a decade or two at the most before the so-called winding up scene would occur. And that's why they were able to sustain that manifesto and to tell others, yes, we will no longer have plural marriages, they had no idea it would be 100 years, and still that great event would not occur. Had they known that, it would have been a very different situation. For example, Lorenzo Snow, who adamantly refused to allow new plural marriages, for the most part, as church president as well as an apostle, he was telling people in general conferences that there are people sitting in this audience today who will go back to Jackson County and help redeem Zion and who will see the face of God. There are not very many people, if any, around that I'm aware of who were in those congregations in 1890. But that's the perception, and it was that perception that allowed them to ratify the manifesto. There were others who did not have that perception, who had a very political view of the manifesto. But there were a number who saw it in those terms and perceived the church in that way, and that's why they were able to accept it.
I wanted to comment on these recommends that Wilford Woodruff signed on the day of the manifesto. I think if you look at the text of the manifesto itself, when the manifesto was issued, it wasn't meant to apply any place but in the United States. I mean, it says laws having been passed by Congress, which the court of last resort has declared to be constitutional. That had never happened in Canada or in Mexico. Now, plural marriage was illegal in Canada. It was illegal in Mexico. The Canadian government was very much opposed to it, but the Mexican government under Diaz was willing to kind of wink at the thing. And the church had already taken the position the year before the manifesto was issued. That new plural marriages could take place if they were to take place in Mexico and if the couple, or at least the wife, was willing to remain in Mexico. A circular letter had been sent out the year before to church officials telling them that that was the new circumstance under which plural marriages were to take place. It wasn't really until 1891... When Wilford Woodruff went before the Master in Chancery to give testimony in order to try to get the church's property back, that he made the statement that it was to apply every place in the world. And after that, he said that he was put in a situation where he had to say that. So I don't think that it's an inconsistency in his position to say that he was willing to sign recommends for people to go to Mexico and have plural marriages and still accept the manifesto as it was understood in 1890. And I think the understanding of what the manifesto meant underwent a process of change as well. With regard to when the church took a definite stand on that question, I think the second manifesto in 1904 is the beginning of the end of that. And I think the appointment of the Lyman Committee, a committee under Francis M. Lyman, who was president of the Council of the Twelve in 1911, was when they really got down to the nuts and bolts of being serious about the matter, because it's at that point that they begin on the level of the Council of the Twelve excommunicating people who'd entered into to new plural marriages after 1904.
Right. The question is, isn't that something that's been identified as Mormon logic?
I don't think it's that at all. It seems to me that it's the kind of intense psychological trauma or difficulty that any person who's faced with what is essentially a conflict of two rights goes through. The church members were taught that they should obey the law of the land, and they were taught also that they should obey the law of God. Now, what happens when those two are in conflict? That's a kind of choice that any person with any sensitivity blanches at having to make. And I think that the church leaders and church members of that period were no different than we would be if we were faced with that sort of choice ourselves. I mean, it's awfully easy to point back and say, well, those people were duplicitous.
They were lying. Imagine the kind of emotional trauma that you go through under those circumstances. You're told to begin with that in order to achieve salvation, the highest degree of the celestial kingdom, you've got to enter into a plural marriage. I mean, when members of the church in the 19th century read the 132nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants, they didn't understand it the way we did, the way we do today. That's part of that change in spiritual worldview that I talked about in my discussion. It was simply a different understanding of that revelation than we have at the present time. But it's during this period that understanding of what the 132nd section means was changed by the general authorities. And still, it's an enormous difficulty for people to accept that kind of change that comes a second nature to us today. I think it's almost impossible for us to put our minds back in the mindset of those people and understand the sort of trauma that they must have gone through when they were told that they couldn't enter into plural marriage and believed then that what that meant was that their salvation was in jeopardy.
There's another conflict, too. It's not just the conflict between you follow the law of the land and you follow the law of God, and what do you do when they're in conflict? But also, Mormons were, particularly in the 19th century, had two different value systems, ethical systems. One was the normative system that you tell the truth, the golden rule, you treat others as you want to be treated. When you say something, it's what you mean. It's what is. But then there's another value system that was within the scriptures. It was published as one of the teachings of Joseph Smith as well, that what is right under one set of circumstances may not be right under another. And that the commandments that seem so basic, such as thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not bear false witness, may not always apply under all circumstances. And this appeal to a higher ethical authority, which may, on occasion, short-circuit normal ethical values, was operating too. And they were caught between those systems. On the one hand, they felt themselves bound to want to live the normative value system. On the other hand, there was also this allowance for an extraordinary value system, however you want to define it, the theological value system, which could short-circuit the normative. And there was a tension there that they were not always happy with themselves, but they were caught in, and the manifesto brought that to very dramatic proportions. And they themselves, within their own discussions as apostles, debated that very question. Should what we say be absolutely true on all occasions? There were some apostles, some members of the First Presidency, who said absolutely yes. We can only do what we say we are doing. We cannot do something that we are denying. On the other hand, there were some members of the First Presidency and Quorum of the Twelve that argued for a theological value system, that we can say we are doing something when in fact we are not. We can say we are not doing something which we are in fact doing because God allows us to make this exception. And so there wasn't uniformity even within the First Presidency or Quorum of the Twelve on basic ethical issues of what it means to, for example, make a statement and what that statement in fact says or doesn't say.
Well, I think that there's something else that you need to take into account, too, and that is what it was that was being threatened. What was being threatened was the loss of the temples. And so, I mean, you're damned if you do, or you're damned if you don't, and you've got to find some way to get through this. It's a Hobson's choice. So, one way or the other.
I have a question for Mike.
Mike, you've invoked a psychoanalytic concept, the identification with the aggressor, which I think, well, to me, it's the most meaningful concept I think I've heard and thought about in terms of understanding this aspect of church history. And I just wonder how you would feel about any further comments about it. I mean, when this process occurs on the individual level, when you identify with the aggressor, what happens is as Freud taught us so very nicely, there's a real repression. It's very, very hard to consciously acknowledge that former position you were in. I think, for example, of a man who himself was abused and abandoned by parents as a child. As he grew up, he identified powerfully with those aggressors and abused his family unbelievably. Yet he was, of course, became the model Mormon. And publicly, he would give his shirt off his back for the homeless, for the others, do the church bidding. But at home, he was aggressing his children in ways that are beyond imagination. And I suspect that, as I have seen many Mormon families, that is not an unusual story, or at least, unfortunately, it's not so rare. But my question is, now, as you've invoked this model, would you be willing to generalize and begin to look in other areas? For example, does this model begin to explain some of the issues around repression and denial around our history? For example, it's very hard for the individual to look at what his past history has been. And certainly we see that almost like an unconscious gap in Mormon history on a mass level. For example, I never could explain in my mind how President McKay, great a man as he was, could sign a document backing the law to disfranchise a polygamous couple by taking their children away. Which seemed to me just, and that was allegedly the only reason, I think it was the Black case or something, or issues around business, the familiar stories of the righteous Latter-day Saint who can go out and scam you in the world without a blink. I'm just wondering if you would be willing to think of those kinds of things or what other thoughts you might have about this model and its extension into current modern symptomatic Mormonism.
I think that's one of the problems of speaking without any notes. One of my best examples is the one I forgot to mention, and that is how, in identifying with the aggressor, once the Mormon Church became serious and uniform in combating new plural marriage, they identified with Victorian aggression against the Church in such a way that they outdid it. There's nothing in American approach, the American government's approach to 19th century polygamous, that exceeds or even reaches what the Mormon Church did to its fundamentalist more polygamous rebels. The LDS Church supported the implementation of laws as felonies for polygamous cohabitation. In its most repressive, the United States government never did that. It never made polygamous cohabitation of a man with his plural wives a felony. With the support and encouragement of the First Presidency, Utah legislature did that. The American government, I'm not aware of even the most radical proposals of the Victorian government or that time period, mid-19th century government, proposing to define polygamous children as abandoned and therefore to adopt all polygamous children out from under the polygamous husbands and wives or mothers and fathers. I'm simply not aware of that ever being even proposed in 19th century society. But in Mormon society, that not only was proposed, that became the law in Utah. It was endorsed. The Deseret News, which was in its editorial, was a function of or an extension of the LDS First Presidency during the 1950s, applauded the decision of the Utah state officials that polygamous children were by definition abandoned children and were by definition therefore subject to seizure and being forcibly placed into homes of non-polygamous parents, foster homes. So I think that in many real ways, the in terms of its attitudes and actions toward polygamous rebels in its within its own context, the LDS Church has indeed exceeded the model of an aggressive parent, if you will, or an aggressive culture that Victorian society gave to the Mormon Church in the 19th century. I hadn't thought of the question of the unwillingness to deal with your past, but it certainly fits. It fits the model. The unwillingness to identify yourself with what you were as a culture in the 19th century as a Mormon people or as a Mormon church, and wanting to identify more with what you are now. It does fit. I hadn't thought of it. And when I press this as a model, I'm not one who argues that anything that fights with the model can't be true. I think it's just a useful way to understand what happened in Mormon society. And how I got to this actually was a question that I couldn't understand. It used to bother me. Why does the LDS Church in the 20th century treat its women the way it does? Why does it define them the way it does in view of the 19th century attitudes toward women? I could never understand that, particularly in terms of how American society itself was developing such openness gradually toward women and women's roles. I couldn't understand why Mormon society was going in the opposite direction. And finally, the only thing that occurred to me is, well, Mormon society was turning to an American ideal that was Victorian. That's why. And then that kind of led me down to the other perceptions. This isn't going to answer everything, but I think the model is useful for answering some things about Mormon society, and some very fundamental, if I can use the word, fundamental things about Mormon society.
Any of you who've been on missions know that one of the first things people know about Mormons is that they have a lot of wives. I heard this day in and day out on my mission in Germany, and that's an enormous embarrassment for church leaders. I think that's one of the reasons that they like to suppress the memory of those events in the past.
I think we have time for maybe one or two more questions. Nola, do you still have a question?
My question is basically, when we look back at these attitudes and the ambivalence that the church leaders had and the double bind they found themselves in, I think there's another aspect which made a double bind for the members, perhaps that third member, the third of the group in the tabernacle or wherever they were, when the manifesto, who voted for the manifesto and felt that they should be able to have confidence that their leaders were actually doing what they said they were doing. It seemed to me that that put those people who had that kind of confidence in a double bind and made the situation even more complex. Are there any ideas on this?
I regard, well, there's a view that all history is ironic because when you look at the past, you understand it in ways that the actors never did, that people who participated, you see the unintended consequences of their actions, and that makes most of their statements and experiences ironic. But it also makes it tragic, and I see Mormon history in terms of the manifesto as really tragic because the people who voted for the manifesto, who expected that the manifesto said what it meant, were just, well, first mystified. First, they denied. And they lived in a case of continual denial. Well, no, these allegations of new plural marriages can't be true because the church has made this position and I have stood for it. And I sustain these men as prophets, seers, and revelators. And they denied. But then their Smoot case, which, for a brief version of what happened, the U.S. Senate for 3 years investigated the church in testimony in Washington, D.C., And essentially, with reference to plural marriage, the Smoot case demonstrated in a number of cases that, in fact, there had been new plural marriages after the manifesto that involved apostles. And that Smoot case alienated many members of the church who had accepted the manifesto at face value and had repeatedly denied the evidence and the allegations of plural marriages after the manifesto, and then had to come face to face with testimony that they could not deny, that in fact there had been a second level of reality. And this whole period is confused, it's ironic, and I do believe it is tragic. And many members of the church remained in the church and began to perceive it in a different way, in an alienated way, from this time period on. They were no longer true believers. They no longer felt they could be true believers. Some of them did not remain in the Mormon fold. They simply walked, voted with their feet, or however you want to define it. And these were not people who you could dismiss as apostate. These were people who had been true believers, whose belief basically was taken from them by a set of contradictions they could not compensate for in their belief system. So this is I regard it as a tragic period. I mean, whether you regard the manifesto as a good thing or a bad thing, what happened in those years after the manifesto, I think, is really tragic.
One final question.
To bring the discussion from the 1890s to the 1990s, I wonder if any members of the panel would care to comment on this kind of phenomenon, which I've seen and I think does make sense in the identification with the aggressor paradigm. One does sometimes see people who convert to the church on the basis of a spiritual testimony of the scriptures, who may be in some outlying area where they don't have much contact with church members, and they're converted essentially to the kind of countercultural vision that Joseph Smith had. And yet when they come into contact with the church, they come into contact with these heavy-duty establishment Victorian values. Aside from the fact that those people are a great pool for the Sunstone subscription list, I'm wondering if any of you care to contact on, is that a valid phenomenon under this kind of paradigm? Do you have any kind of historical insight to bring to this idea?
Maybe heavy-duty Victorian values is the counterculture.
The only comment I have on that is because of recent field work I've done with fundamentalist Mormon fundamentalist wives and teenage children in polygamous families today. There was a woman a plural wife that I interviewed who had that identical experience, although I think this doesn't necessarily lend people toward the dialogue Sunstone direction. She read the Doctrine and Covenants before her baptism and read section 132 of the Doctrine and Covenants and was converted spiritually to the idea of polygamy. She joined the church thinking it was polygamous and was stunned after her membership in the church a few weeks or months after her membership to learn that polygamy wasn't allowed in Mormonism anymore. And she was converted. She was a fundamentalist. She said, I was a fundamentalist before I was baptized into the LDS Church. And then she had to find a home. And it's not surprising that her home became the fundamentalist movement. So, yeah, that is an experience. I don't think it's a very common one, but it is a potentially valid experience in terms of somebody reading the Doctrine and Covenants and without being warned ahead, this revelation doesn't mean what it says. Read a few pages after this revelation, and then you'll know what this revelation really says. Most people aren't prepared for that in that way, and so I think it's a rare experience, but that was her experience. But I don't think that lent her toward the Sunstone dialogue group.
I was just going to say in regard to that, it seems to me that for most people, the experience of moving into the church is at least two-staged and perhaps more than that. People have a conversion experience, and I'm not certain in every case just what it is that that brings them to that conversion. But following that, there has to be an acculturation experience where they're brought into the community. They're converted to principles, or they find something in the church that leads them to want to join, but they have to be brought into the community in some way, and it's at that critical stage that people decide whether they're going to remain in or not.
Thank you, Tom, Jan, and Michael. We'll reconvene in the morning.